Since Senator Lieberman's federal hearings on game violence in December 1993, the industry had raced to find a response that would curtail the threat of government involvement. After another hearing in the spring of 1994, the result was the Interactive Digital Software Association, a trade organization representing all the major publishers, joined for the purpose of self-regulation. By the fall of 1994, the IDSA had a voluntary system, the Entertainment Software Rating Board, which would assign ratings much as the movie industry did, T for teen, M for mature. The first game that would bear its mark would be Doom 2. Id not only escaped unscathed, but found its bad boy image further enhanced. The hearings had, ironically, heralded a new, meaner, more violent era in video games, and the gamers of the world couldn't get enough. Sega's Night Trap sold out around the country. With the rating system in place, publishers felt freer to release edgier content. Even Nintendo joined in the party, making plans to release a version of Mortal Kombat 2, gore and all. But no developer was positioned quite like Id. Now, as the media and fans descended, all it needed was a face, someone they could pin their worship on. At Id, there was no competition. When it came time for a lead singer of the band to emerge, John Romero wasn't only perfect, he was the only one who wanted the job. "We're not worthy! We're not worthy! We're not worthy!" the gamers chanted, bowing at Romero's feet. It was a scorching hot afternoon in Austin, Texas. Romero and Sean Green were standing inside Austin Virtual Gaming, a 600-square-foot shop above a coffee shop on the main strip outside the University of Texas. Five Doom junkies from the school's zoology department and local high-tech companies had pooled their cash to open this place just a few weeks before. They figured they weren't the only ones in town hooked on Id's demonic creation. So they networked a small fleet of personal computers with 27-inch screens and began charging gamers $8 per hour to deathmatch. The occasion this day was the game room's first official Doom tournament. And, to the elation of the few dozen gamers gathered around the red pulsing monitors to play, Romero, one of the guys who wrote the game, was here to fight. Though few, if any, of the gamers had seen pictures of Romero, they figured he was the guy wearing the black t-shirt with the militaristic Doom logo on the front and the bold white words, "Wrote It," on the back. The shirt was Romero's own modification. After Id had printed up a bunch of promotional tees, he suggested they add the phrase, "Wrote It," for their own. He even sent his mother a Doom shirt with the words, "My son wrote it," on the back. Carmack preferred his own favorite shirt, a yellow smiley face with a bloody bullet hole piercing the forehead. Romero had taken to wearing the "Wrote It" shirt everywhere, around the office, around town, around gaming conventions. The shirt had a Moses-like effect. Gamers would spot him in the shirt and do a celebrity double take, parting as he moved through the crowd. The brave few would venture forward with sweaty palms and shaky hands. It happened first outside of CompUSA when the clerk came sheepishly after Romero, who was getting into his yellow Testarossa, and asked for an autograph. Such displays were becoming a regular occurrence, especially when he donned the "Wrote It" shirt. Gamers began not only asking for autographs, but literally falling to their knees and echoing the "We're not worthy" refrain that Saturday Night Live characters Wayne and Garth bestowed upon rock royalty. The other guys at Id couldn't believe it. In fact, they were embarrassed by it. "We aren't Metallica. We're gamers." But as the enigma around the company grew, the fans and media wanted more and more information about just who Id was. In response, the guys created a news file that gamers could obtain by sending a message request, or, in technical slang, fingering Id's computers. They started posting regular updates about technical matters, but soon the news expanded into lifestyle, giving the skinny on, among other things, the status of Carmack's and Romero's Ferraris. Fans began to build a sense of wonder about the company, which, as they discovered, was spilling over into real life. This was something new, as Jay described it, nerd worship. And there was no one who liked being worshipped more than Romero. Not only had he printed up the shirts, but he was starting to change his appearance, growing out his dark hair, wearing his contacts more often. But he didn't look at the bowing gamers as his minions. He saw them as his peers, his friends. Here were all these people, he thought as he looked down on their bowing skulls, who loved games as much as he did. As the Doom momentum built, after all, Romero was becoming as addicted to the game as his fans were. He and Sean were now deathmatching on a regular basis, staying long into the night. When he wasn't playing Doom, Romero was talking about Doom. He was a regular attendant in the burgeoning Doom chat rooms and message boards and news groups, discussing the latest mods, deathmatch tourneys, and technical happenings. To the outside world, Romero was id. This was as much the others doing as it was his. The other owners had no interest in courting the fans or the press. Jay, id's biz guy, did his share, but that came with the territory. When the press wanted to strut out one of the Doom gods, one of the guys who wrote it, Romero fit the bill. And as Carmack, Adrian, and the rest readily acknowledged, Romero was good at it. Funny, likable, bouncing off the walls with energy. He had been the company's biggest cheerleader from the moment he saw the Dangerous Dave and copyright infringement demo. When he hyped the company, it wasn't merely the hype of an owner. It was the hype of id's biggest fan. The language of that hype was the language of deathmatch. Confident to the point of egotism, inspired to the point of confrontation. Id was the ruler of the world, and Romero was quick to make everyone aware of just how great they were and how much greater they would become. The plan, he posted online, is to get the entire world running next step for development, get everyone connected on the internet, and own a Testarossa TR-512. Romero lashed out at the popular and emerging operating systems. DOS blows. DOS extenders create developer hell. Windows sucks. By the time he showed up in Austin for the Doom deathmatch in the summer of 1994, Romero was exuding white-hot game god heat. With the fans bowing, a reporter descended on him and asked why he had come to this tournament. Romero puffed out his chest and said, "So we can beat everybody." Romero and Sean found their seats while others played. It was silent, except for the sounds of fingers rattling on keys. But all that changed as the id guys began to play. Romero hurled a few shotgun blasts into an opponent and yelled, "Eat that, fucker!" The sheepish guy on the other computer looked up in fear. Sean knew that look. The look of gamer who had never heard true, unbridled smack talk, just like he'd been the first time he had heard Romero insult him during a game. But now, Sean was a pro and joined right in. "Suck it down, monkey fuck," he called, after firing a few blasts from his BFG. The gamers cowered. They would learn. Romero savored the long drive back to Dallas in his Ferrari. Life was good for the 26-year-old. He had been beaten down by his father and stepfather, picked himself back up, and now, after all this time, finally arrived. He really was the ace programmer, the future rich person. He had mended his relationship with his parents, who now had a new perspective on their son's wayward days at the arcades. He loved his new wife, Beth, and sons Michael and Stephen, who, though still in California, could proudly call him their dad. He had become the man he had envisioned all those years before. One night back at the office, Romero decided to share his feeling of success. He stepped into Carmack's office to find his partner, as usual, sitting at his PC with a Diet Coke. Since Doom's release, Carmack had immersed himself in side projects, programming conversions or ports of Doom for other game platforms, including the Atari Jaguar and the new console from Sega. Id was getting good money for the gigs, $250,000 from Atari alone. But for Carmack, it wasn't the cash that was intriguing. It was the opportunity to get back into the trenches. This was what he truly loved. The work, the rolling up of the sleeves, the challenging of his intellect. And he at least somewhat appreciated the rush of fortune and fame. On a recent trip home, he told his father, the renowned Kansas City anchorman, that he would soon be as famous as he was. Like Romero, Carmack had found peace with his parents, who now admired and supported his work. His mother played Commander Keen in her spare time. He had even gone out on a few dates with a woman whose parents owned a Chinese restaurant he frequented. Still, he was spending the majority of his days and nights at ID. Nothing pleased him quite like sharpening his chops with low-level programming work. He would need the skills, he knew, when he went off to create his next big game engine. But while he had been here, he was beginning to notice, Romero was gone. Deathmatching, doing interviews, corresponding with fans online. Something was changing, slipping away, and the work, Carmack thought, was beginning to suffer. Doom 2 was falling behind schedule. While Romero was out being the company rock star, the levels that he had promised to create were not getting done. In fact, the company was now relying on other level designers, Sandy Peterson and a new employee, American McGee, to get the majority of the levels done. Out of the 32 levels of Doom 2, Carmack noted, only 6 were shaping up to be Romero's. Romero had his explanation. The levels he made simply took more time. But Carmack suspected something else. Romero was losing his focus. In addition to the interviews and the deathmatching, Romero was now acting as executive producer on an upcoming game by Raven, the company they knew from Wisconsin. Romero had approached Carmack at one point with the idea to milk the Doom engine for all it was worth. "Let's make some more games using our technology," he said. "Let's get some stuff out there, because we can get some money off of this. And Raven's a good group that would be perfect for licensing the engine and making a great game that we can publish." Carmack agreed, but without enthusiasm. How much bigger did they need to get? For Romero, though, it wasn't just about getting bigger. It was about fun. He loved playing games. He lived for playing games. And there was no game that was more fun than Doom. The deal with Raven would give him more games to play. This night in Carmack's office, Romero spelled out his new life code. It was time to enjoy ID's accomplishments. No crunch mode. No more bloodshot nights. No more death schedules, he happily said. Carmack remained quiet. The cursor on his monitor pulsed. In the past, Romero would have stayed here by his side, experimenting with the engine on screen, testing bugs until the sun came up. Tonight, Carmack watched the guy in the Rodit shirt walk out the door. Chapter 11. Quakes. Everyone has unfulfilled dreams. Maybe the dreams are too costly or time-consuming. Fly a plane, drive a race car. Maybe they're too far out. Fight an alien space war, stalk a vampire. Or maybe they're illegal. Streak through the suburbs, hunt down the boss with a sawed-off shotgun. But the dreams are there, nonetheless, animating minds every day. This is why there is a multi-billion-dollar industry that lets people explore these fantasies the best way technology allows. This is why there are video games. Of course, video games don't let people really live their dreams. They let gamers live a developer's simulation of a dream. The action is digital. It's confined to a computer or a television or a handheld device. Players experience it through their eyes, ears, and fingertips. But when they're done careening down the Daytona Speedway or storming an interstellar military base, they feel as if they've really been somewhere, as if they've momentarily transcended their sack of fat and bones, their office politics, their mounting bills. Games let them escape, learn, recharge. Games are necessary.
This belief has existed since ancient Greece, when Plato said, "Every man and woman should play the noblest games and be of another mind from what they are at present." In the 50s, the anthropologist Johann Heisinger wrote that play is a significant function which transcends the immediate needs of life and imparts meaning to the action. All play means something. He suggested a new name for the human species, Homo ludens, man the player. Marshall McLuhan wrote in the 60s that a society without games is one sunk in the zombie trance of the automaton. Games are popular art, collective, social reactions to the main drive or actions of any culture. The games of a people reveal a great deal about them. They are a sort of artificial paradise, like Disneyland, or some utopian vision by which we interpret and complete the meaning of our daily lives. By 1994, there was no more utopian vision of a game than the holodeck, and the dream of this virtual world simulator on Star Trek was inching from science fiction to reality. Neal Stephenson's sci-fi novel Snow Crash, published in 1992, imagined the metaverse, an alternate reality similar to the cyberspace envisioned in William Gibson's 1984 novel Neuromancer. The internet was taking off, capable of connecting humans into such a domain. Arcades buzzed with virtual reality games, unseemly machines with big clunky headsets that for about $5 immersed a player in a first-person polygon world. A new generation of programmers was devoting their work, their lives, to realizing the holodeck. As John Carmack said, "It's a moral imperative that we must create this." His contribution would be Quake. The development of every id game began with Carmack telling the other guys what his next graphic engine would be capable of doing. When Carmack first described his vision of the Quake technology, Romero nearly combusted. They had talked about doing Quake, after all, for years. The idea came straight out of their old Dungeons & Dragons games. Quake was the character Carmack had invented who possessed a powerful hammer, capable of demolishing buildings, as well as a supernatural conjuring object, Hellgate Cube, floating above his head. Id had first worked on a Quake game back in the early Commander Keen days, but gave up because they felt the technology was not yet powerful enough to do their idea justice. Now, Carmack said, the time had come. The technology was ready to make the most convincingly immersive 3D experience yet. The first fast-action, first-person game to support groups of players competing together over the internet. Not only would Quake be id's most ambitious game yet, but it could be the world's. Romero exploded with ideas. A full 3D engine, he said. Hell, we can have forests and stuff. The artifact that we talked about in Keen, the Hammer of Thunderbolts, that's going to be your main weapon in Quake. And you're going to have this trans-dimensional artifact, the Hellgate Cube, a cube that orbits your head, and it will just do things. It'll have its personality and its own programming to where you feel like it's a different entity. It'll attack people if you're good to it. If you're whacking on someone and taking damage off someone, then the cube feeds off of pain basically at a certain distance around it. So the more pain you do, the happier the cube is. So it will start doing things for you. It will heal you when you get screwed up, or it will teleport you somewhere else. And if you don't fight for a long time, it'll start damaging you, or it would take off, and maybe it'll come back one day. Romero was so excited, he just had to share the news with all id's fans. "The next game is going to blow Doom all to hell," he typed. "Doom totally sucks in comparison to our next game, Quake, the Fight for Justice. Quake is going to be a bigger step over Doom than Doom was over Wolf 3D. You know, Doom equals Pong." Romero smacked his keyboard and uploaded the message to the internet. But with Doom 2 still in development, all the Quake talk began striking the other owners as premature. Romero's going out and telling people what we're doing, Adrian lamented to Kevin and Jay, even though we know that all our stuff is going to change, so there's no need to tell the public all these plans. Romero just likes all the attention, which is why he does it. Jay, having been flamed by gamers on numerous occasions after id missed its promised deadlines for Doom, heard Adrian loud and clear. Let's not talk about stuff at this point that's still projection, he told Romero, because if it doesn't come to fruition, there's backlash. Romero agreed, but soon caved in once again. Quake won't be just a game, he told Computer Player magazine. It will be a movement. He had to be stopped. Late one night in September 1994, Romero sat at his computer, tweaking the final sounds for Doom 2. With the game near completion, he took it upon himself to polish the audio effects for the final enemy, or boss, of the game, called the Icon of Sin. To win the game, the player had to shoot the Icon, a hideous beast that spit out cubes that could spawn into other monsters, between the eyes. Romero ran around in a special mode that allowed him to, for purposes of testing the game, pass through walls, effectively going behind the images the player would see in the game. He had just passed behind a wall in back of the Icon of Sin when he stopped cold. Did I just see my own face? Shrugging it off, he went on with his work, thinking maybe he had been there too long. But then, as he ran behind the beast again, he thought he saw his face once more. How weird, he thought, slowly creeping back. And then, to his shock, he saw it. A digital copy of his head, decapitated and bloody, writhing on a stick. No fucking way, he said. Romero raced his character back around and fired a shot at the Icon of Sin. Then followed the trajectory of the rocket. It sailed through the beast, through a back wall, into the hidden chamber, and smack into Romero's head, which would twitch in agony. Romero got the joke. The player thought he was winning the game by shooting the beast, but in fact, he was shooting Romero. Romero was the Icon of Sin. The next morning, word spread around the office that Romero had found the Easter egg and left one of his own. Adrian and Kevin booted up the final scene of the game and began firing off the rockets at the beast. All the while, they heard demonic sounds, like a backward track of a Judas Priest song coming from the hidden room. The words were indistinguishable, but, when reversed, perfectly clear. "To win the game," the voice bellowed, "you must kill me, John Romero." With another blast of the rocket, the Icon of Sin was dead. On October 10th, 1994, Doom 2 hit the limelight. Limelight, a one-time church in New York City that had been converted into a gothic nightclub, was the site of the Doomsday press party for Doom 2. TSI Communications, the high-powered public relations company hired by GTI to break id Software into the mainstream, used a sizable chunk of the game's $2 million marketing budget to convert the club into a hellish mansion of demons and gore. A holograph machine near the front door projected beasts from the game. The techno-rock soundtrack from the game pumped through the halls. A giant deathmatch arena constructed in the center of the church pulsed with Doom players who had been flown in for the event. Reporters representing every paper, from the Wall Street Journal to the Village Voice, mingled through the crowd with awe and confusion. There was a growing fascination with computer culture and the internet, buoyed by that month's release of Netscape Navigator, the new web browser from the creators of Mosaic. Though many had heard about the underground success of Doom, they had never witnessed the strange new world firsthand. Even Audrey Mann, the publicist in charge of the event for TSI, was taken aback. Her company had long represented two of the heaviest hitters in the high-tech industry, IBM and Sony, but they had never faced the unique challenges that came with the id Software account. Launching Doom 2 brought a whole new vernacular to the PR industry, Words like deathmatch and frag and mods. They debated the appropriateness of terms like kick-ass in a press release. How many ways can we say mutilate? They joked. But when they saw the response at the Limelight, they realized they had underestimated their client. We didn't think it was worth a story, Audrey said. We thought we were just launching a game. Doom 2, it was clear that night, would become not just a game, but in fact a movement. Reporters, who had previously ignored Jay's pitches about the company, now besieged any id gamer they could corner. Protesters muscled in too. With violent films like Natural Born Killers and Pulp Fiction on the radar, Doom was perceived as yet another threat to the youth of America. During Jay's speech to the crowd, a man stood up in the rafters and screamed, "You should be ashamed for making such violent games that children can play!" Everyone fell silent, looking to Jay for a response. "Sir," Jay said calmly, "I have two children. I would never do anything that would hurt them. To some extent, we're creating the Three Stooges of interactive media with guns. If you look at this from the top down, this is more humorous than it is damaging." But the protester wouldn't relent, screaming about violence and Satan, until finally Sean Green, who was sitting next to Jay on stage, rose to the microphone and yelled, "Suck it down, dude!" The crowd laughed. Everyone, it seemed, was on id's side. 600,000 copies of Doom 2 were sold to retail stores for the initial release, guaranteeing that it would be among the best-selling games in history. The inventory was supposed to last a quarter. It lasted 1 month. After the Doomsday event, the mainstream media snowballed around the game. Anyone who'd missed the so-called Doom cult the first time around jumped on board, while the ones who had been hip the whole time trumpeted their pioneer status. Journalists from all walks cooed over the game's immersion, the marketing scheme, the violence, the great American success story. "It's as close to virtual reality as you're going to get," gushed the Chicago Sun-Times. "Virtual mayhem and real profits," headlined the New York Times. The Economist published an essay titled "Doomonomics," which academically explored how the drippingly gory computer game took its creators from obscurity to riches. "It's a tale that holds a lesson of striking relevance to tomorrow's information economy." The Red Herring marveled that id had an entire file filled with letters from VCs and private investors who are just dying to sink cash into the company. Yet the company was remaining staunchly and profitably independent. Of course, the millions of players who were living the game could give two flying fireballs about any of those things. What was really selling the game, they knew, was Deathmatch. And the person who wanted to own Deathmatch was Dwango Bob. Dwango Bob, a.k.a. Bob Huntley, was a 34-year-old who looked and behaved like a Texas version of the Woodstock MC, Wavy Gravy. He'd gotten into the high-tech industry by producing interactive kiosks for gas stations throughout Houston. After some years, though, he began to burn out on the fumes. He was looking for something else, and he found it in Doom. During the early part of 1994, the Dwango guys were falling behind on work, staying at the office until 2 a.m., lying to their wives so they could play the game. Bob's partner, Key Kimbrell, had become yet another blissful victim of Doom addiction. Bob pulled Key aside one night and said, "If every machine is not clear of Doom, you're fired." Key didn't have the nerve. Instead of deleting the game, he renamed the file so Bob wouldn't find it, and kept on playing. When Bob found out the truth, something clicked. If these guys are this passionate about this game, maybe there's something to it. Bob sat down for one round, and his life changed forever. The thrill he found was in the head-to-head competition, playing against real live people over a local area computer network. With some research online, he realized he was hardly alone. Doom Deathmatch was taking over lives. Fans hijacked their office networks to play all weekend, threw their kids out of their basements to wire together their own arenas, and put off so many trips to the bathroom that at least one player, who had been consuming ding-dong cupcakes during a marathon match, explosively defecated in his pants mid-game. How incredible would it be, Bob and Key mused, if a gamer could just go out and pick up a game against random people who were far away, in some other house, some other room, some other state. What if there could be a computer hub or server that would turn the game into the virtual equivalent of a pickup basketball game on a neighborhood court, except that people could play together from anywhere in the world? Problem was, Doom didn't work that way. It supported only modem-to-modem play. This meant that to compete, one gamer would use a modem to telephone another's computer. Once connected, they could play against each other. Undaunted, Key looked over at Bob and said, "You know, I think that we can get this to play over a phone line." "Okay," Bob said, seeing dollar signs. "You've got 6 weeks. If you get it together, then I promise to get us an introduction to id Software." Bob was bluffing. He didn't know id from Shinola. But, seeing as that they were Texas boys, he figured they'd be easy enough to enlist. They weren't. His calls, like so many others, went unanswered. 5 weeks later, Key sped from his house on his bike to tell Bob the news. "I've got it," he said, panting. "Give me 10 minutes. Bob sat down at his computer while Key banged away at his keyboard in another room. 10 minutes later, Bob got the signal and booted up the program Key had created. He saw a simple little interface that streamlined all the difficulties of multiplayer action. With this program, anyone could dial up through a phone and connect to a computer system that hosted the game. Instead of having to be in one place, someone could just dial a number, join a chat room, then click off to play three other people in Doom. "Okay," Key said, smiling. "Now we have to get a hold of id." Bob lowered his eyes and broke the news. "Id's not talking," he said. "Hell, they ain't even answering the phone." He tried more faxes, letters, emails, but nothing worked. Just as they were about to lose hope, Bob came across an article about the upcoming Doom 2 press event at the Limelight in New York. He called id's publicity firm. "I've got a big opportunity for id," he said, "and just have to get into the event." The guy on the phone told him people from all over the world were trying to get in. Forget about it. But Bob persisted and sweet-talked him down. "Okay," the guy finally relented. "If you want to fly up from Houston, I'll see what I can do." Bob hung up the phone and turned to Key. "We're going to New York," he said. Key and Bob bought plane tickets with frequent flyer mileage and booked a room at a Holiday Inn in New Jersey. With their last business in shambles, they were living off breadcrumbs. They banked everything on their new service for Doom, which they had dubbed the Dial-Up Wide Area Network Games Operation, or Dwango. Hours before the event, Bob and Key showed up at the club and met the guy from TSI. "Okay," he said, hurriedly, handing them two t-shirts. "Put these on." Bob and Key squeezed into the small black t-shirts, which had the militaristic Doom logo on the front and Contestant on the back. The only way they could get in, the publicist told them, was to pose as contestants for the Doom Deathmatch. Bob and Key looked around. Behind them were dozens of skinny guys half their age in the same t-shirts. Bob gulped. Sure, he and Key had played Doom, but they sucked compared with the hardcore gamers. Now they were supposed to play the game against these champs on a stage in front of the national press? They thanked the guy, then snuck across the street to fuel up at a bar. They stumbled back later to find the TSI guy screaming, "You missed the lineup! Hurry up! Get inside!" Bob was first up for battle. He got wiped out within minutes. He lost just as quickly. Game's done, they went to find Id. They ended up tracking down Jay Wilmer, who looked at these beer-soaked, middle-aged guys in tight contestant shirts and shrugged them off. "No time, not interested, go away," he said, and disappeared into the crowd. Just as they were moping toward the door, Key spotted Romero, with his unmistakable long, dark hair and Doom Wrote It t-shirt. They waited nervously for their break, then closed in. "We made this software," Key said eagerly. "You can dial in with your modem to a server, and you can play other people over the modem. Here's the only disc we got. Guard it with your life." After the party, Romero told Jay about the disc. The Duango idea wasn't breakthrough. Id had thought of it themselves, but just hadn't gotten around to programming it. Since Quake was going to be playable over the internet, they had figured they would hold off on creating the multiplayer online feature. Anyway, Jay concurred, he certainly didn't want some bozos doing the job, not when they had companies like AOL and Time Warner calling. "Well," Romero said, "maybe I'll take 5 minutes and see what this disc does." Back home in Texas, Romero popped the disc in his hard drive and dialed up the Houston number. After his modem whooshed, he saw a message on screen from Key. "Come on, let's try a game." Next thing he knew, there they were. Key in Houston, Romero in Dallas, playing a spontaneous pickup game of Doom 2 Deathmatch. Romero picked up the phone. "That is fucking cool," he said, "'cause my whole thing is I like staying up late, and I want to play people whenever the fuck I want to, and I don't want to have to wake up my buddy at 3 a.m. and go, 'Hey, want to get your skull cracked, huh? That's just not cool, and I want to do it 24/7 at any time. This is it. This is the thing that you can dial into and just play.'" But Carmack and the other owners weren't enthused. As far as Carmack was concerned, this smacked of yet another of Romero's diversions, like interviews, Raven, deathmatching, to distract him from the real work at hand, making games. Romero argued that if they could get online play going and further build the Doom community, it would surely help grow the company. After having Jay negotiate a deal for 20% of the Duango revenues, Romero spent every night working on the project, which would be released with the shareware of Heretic, the game Romero had been overseeing for Raven. On December 23, 1994, he phoned Bob and Key and said, "I'm fixing to upload this. Do you think you can handle it? Because when it hits, it's going to overwhelm you guys." He was right. News of Duango spread immediately through the burgeoning Doom fan base. By January 1995, 10,000 people were paying $8.95 per month to dial up to Bob and Key's Houston server. People were dialing from as far as Italy and Australia. At this rate, Duango would break $1 million with just one server. They had to expand. And expanding wasn't that difficult to do. The guts of a Duango computer server was simply a computer and a few dozen modems with phone lines. All they had to do was buy the parts and strike deals with people across the country who would host the machines in their own homes or offices. Bob, Key, and Mike Wilson, a former daiquiri bar manager and childhood buddy of Adrian Carmack's, went on a cross-country spree to set up Duango franchises. It was a tantalizing pitch. For $35,000, Duango would set up a server and then let the franchisee rake in the cash. It was, Mike said, a guaranteed money-making machine. Lawyers, programmers, musicians, people from all walks of life, including Adrian Carmack, snatched up the deals. The Duango guys put one in a private loft in New York, apartments in Seattle, warehouses in San Jose. They set up 22 servers in about 4 months. Every day, the guys would run to the nearest Home Depot to load up on shelving and cables, then hightail it over to install a new machine, and walk out the door with $35,000. Cash. On one night, they spent $10,000 at a strip club. The strippers were intrigued when they heard the guys made all this money selling Deathmatch. Whatever that drug was, they figured, it must be some powerful stuff. With the deathmatch fever and rising publicity, Doom 2 not only broke into the retail market, but destroyed it. To Ron Chimowitz's and GTI's delight, the game shot up the charts. A few months after its release, Romero and Jay cruised through the drive-through window of the local bank to deposit their first royalty check. The teller pulled the check out of the deposit tube and nearly collapsed. It was for $5 million. For that amount, she figured, the two guys in the Ferrari should at least have come inside. By the time Romero returned to Austin Virtual Gaming for the next Doom tournament, he was no longer the only one screaming insults and punching walls. Deathmatch was now a way of life. The room brimmed with guys telling each other to suck it down and fuck a monkey skull. There were broken keyboards and ripped up mouse cords on the floor. One far wall was punched through to the core, the lingering wound inflicted by a frustrated gamer's fist. And, for the first time, Romero got beaten at his own game. It wasn't the last time. Fueled by the success of Dwango and Doom 2, Romero deathmatched more than ever with his office mate Sean Green. One day in the summer of 1995, Carmack had enough. He was tired of Romero wasting his time, tired of hearing the screams, the profanity, the fists beating on the walls, the broken keyboards flying down by his door. So, unbeknownst to Romero, he plotted some revenge. The next day, Sean came into Romero's office, beaming with confidence, and challenged Romero to a game. "Jesus, dude," Romero said. "Yesterday, I beat you down so hard. Come on, get in there. I'm ready any time." Everyone gathered around. Romero cracked open a Dr. Pepper and began to play. He chased Sean online, running through the levels, but to no avail. Sean was annihilating him. Every time Romero ran behind him, Sean spun around and unloaded a shotgun into Romero's face. "Fucking bullshit!" Romero screamed. "What's wrong with this fucking mouse?" He banged the mouse on the table, inadvertently spilling his soda. "Oh, shit!" Everyone started to laugh. "What?" Romero said, mopping the Dr. Pepper from his leg. It was a setup, they told him. Carmack had programmed an option on Sean's computer that enabled him to travel at 10 times the average speed just by typing in a special little command. Romero looked around, and sure enough, there was Carmack standing in the hallway. Carmack rarely laughed, but at the moment, he was visibly amused. If Deathmatch was a release from stress, work, family, and drudgery, it was a release that Carmack didn't need, or, for that matter, understand. In fact, he had never really gotten the appeal most people found in hapless diversions. He would see things on television about drunken spring break beach weekends, and none of it would compute. A lot of people didn't seem to enjoy their work. Carmack knew well and good what he enjoyed: programming, and was systematically arranging his life to spend the most time possible doing just that. Beginning with Doom, he had decided to adjust his biological clock to accommodate a more monkish and solitary work schedule, free from Romero's screams, the reporter's calls, and the mounting distractions of everyday life. He began by pushing himself to stay up 1 hour later every evening, and then coming in 1 hour later the next day. By early 1995, he had arrived at his ideal schedule, coming into work at around 4 p.m. and leaving at 4 a.m. He would need all the concentration he could muster for Quake. The game, he quickly realized, was going to be a greater challenge than he had anticipated. His objective was to create an arbitrary 3D world with internet play. Carmack began the project as he often did, by reading as much research material as he could gather. He paid thousands of dollars for textbooks and papers, but everything was purely academic. There was no such thing as a computer program that could create an interactive, real-time, fast-action 3D gaming world. To create such an experience would tax not only every ounce of his skills, but every drop of power a modern PC could muster. To make matters worse, for the first time at such a crucial moment in a game's birth, he felt his ally Romero was nowhere to be found. It had been coming, of course, he thought. Though Carmack had considered Romero a better programmer when they met at Soft Disk, he'd soon left Romero behind. At that point, Romero willfully took on other roles, developing the extraneous tools that he and Tom Hall could use to create levels of a game, conceptualizing design, plotting how id would rule the world. Through Doom, Romero had become the ideal collaborator for Carmack, someone who could sit by his side and knowledgeably experiment with the new technology. With Quake, Carmack realized, he wanted both a programmer who could work with his engine and someone who could experiment with his early work. Romero had once assumed both roles. With the distractions of Doom's success, it seemed to Carmack, he would assume neither. But, as Carmack discovered, there were others who were more than ready to fill the spots. For the programming, there was no one better in Carmack's mind than the veteran coder, Michael Abrash. It was Abrash's book on Power Graphics Programming for Computers that Carmack and Romero had used to learn how to program the graphics for their earlier games. Since then, Abrash had become something of an icon in the programming world. In recent years, he had led graphics programming for Microsoft, where he worked on their Windows NT operating system. But, like anyone who lived for graphics, he knew there was no better place to see results than in games. And there was no game that impressed him quite like Doom. On a trip to Seattle to visit his mother, Carmack took Abrash out to lunch to tell him about his plans for Quake. The challenge, as Abrash heard it, was to increase cyberspace through 3D graphics and a persistent online world, an alternate world that would live and breathe around the clock waiting for players to cohabit. Abrash's blood pulsed. Like most graphics programmers, he often theorized about virtual worlds. When he read Snow Crash and the description of the metaverse, he'd thought, I know how to do 80% right now, at least theoretically. There was no question in his mind that he was sitting across from a 24-year-old who had the skills and confidence to make it happen. When Abrash mentioned how, after a project, he always wondered if he could do anything quite as good again, Carmack narrowed his brow and said, I never wonder that. Still, when Carmack asked him to come work for id, Abrash said he'd have to give it some thought, since it meant uprooting his family. Days later, he got an email from his boss, Bill Gates. Gates had caught wind of the id deal and wanted to talk. Abrash was shocked. A meeting with Gates was like a meeting with the Pope. Gates was aware of id. His programmers had been talking with the company about creating a version of the game for the upcoming Windows platform. But id was just a small company down in Texas, he told Abrash. Microsoft had plenty to offer, he said, and regaled Abrash with the interesting research the company was planning to pursue in graphics. Gates also mentioned how a Microsoft employee had gone to work for IBM, only to return 8 months later. You might not like it down there at id, he concluded. Abrash chose Carmack over Gates. The potential at id was too great, he thought. He wanted to have a front row seat to see that breakthrough virtual world, that networked 3D world, evolve. Furthermore, he was touched by the subtext of Carmack's invitation. Carmack seemed lonely, Abrash thought, like he didn't have anyone who appreciated the beauty of his ideas. Carmack soon expanded his own crew even more. He found an ambitious level designer who was especially eager to put his dreams into action. American McGee connected with Carmack not through games, but through Carmack's other fetish, automobiles. Carmack met him one day in his apartment complex while American was under the hood of a car. Skeletal, chain-smoking, with grease-speckled glasses and a badly grown beard, American was a tightly wound auto mechanic. He spoke in fast bursts like a race car driver jumping the gates, rushing forth, then going back and blasting out again. American's blood was a strange fuel. Just 21 years old, he would often joke to his friends that he wanted to write an autobiography of dysfunction, ironically titled Growing Up American. Born in Dallas, American never knew his father and was raised by his eccentric mother, a house painter. He was a highly creative, if not odd, only child. At school, he would talk vividly to imaginary friends. He would stop in his tracks to draw a doorway in thin air, which he would walk through to get to imaginary places. He was also gifted in math and science and took an early interest in computer programming, eventually getting accepted to a magnet school for computer science. After living with a flurry of stepfathers, American's mother finally settled on a man who thought he was a woman. One day when American was 16, he came home from school to every kid's nightmare: an empty house. The only things left were his bed, his books, his clothes, and his Commodore 64 computer. His mother had sold the home to pay for two plane tickets and the fee for her boyfriend's sex change operation. American packed up his computer. He was on his own. To pay his bills, he dropped out of high school and took a variety of odd jobs, finally settling on a Volkswagen repair shop. In Carmack, he found someone who shared his interest in both cars and computers. When Carmack asked him if he wanted to work at id doing technical support shortly after Doom's release, he jumped. The id office was palpably awesome, American thought. He could feel the momentum, these irreverent young guys riding a tidal wave. Particularly impressive was Ramiro. There was a real sense of magic to his work. It was like he was an architect, an engineer, a lighting person, a game designer, an artist, all in one. Romero had an intuitive sense of how to surprise the player and make the game flow. On top of that, he seemed just plain cool. Living large, driving the hot car, always joking, and unlike Carmack, actually enjoying his fame and fortune. American and Romero, too, became fast friends. American never wanted to go home. With Doom 2, Romero and Carmack agreed to promote American to level design. American repaid the favor by emulating both Carmack's ruthless work schedule and Romero's ruthless sense of fun. In turn, he became the ultimate id prodigy. As a level designer, he had a fine aesthetic sense as well as a natural feeling for entertainment. In one level of Doom 2 he called the Crusher, he placed a cyber demon in the middle of the room. When the player approached, a giant upper section of the room would come mashing down like a hammer. Romero thought it was hilarious. Carmack was equally impressed by American's long hours. By the end of Doom 2, American had completed more levels than Romero himself. As Quake's development began, American was not only id's hotshot young designer, but Carmack's best friend. With Romero off working on his various projects, it was American who experimented with Carmack late into the night. Carmack began to open up to American about Romero. He said he didn't know what to do with Romero, whose passion for programming games seemed to be getting taken over by his passion for playing them. Despite his empathy for Romero, American wanted to appease Carmack, so he said, "Yeah, I think Romero's slacking off too." As Carmack listened, his mood turned. Who did American think he was? He was no Romero. Carmack thought Romero, despite his flaws, was still the best level designer at the company. His levels were the best ones in Doom and the best ones in Doom 2. There was no reason he couldn't still be the best one for Quake. "Romero is a really strong finisher," Carmack said, "and until you see it, you're not going to understand." Romero knew Carmack. He knew that, at the beginning of a project, Carmack went into research mode, and there was nothing much for him to do but experiment with other things until the engine was done. As Romero had already noticed, American had taken on the role of experimenting with Carmack late at night. He didn't think anything of it. Better American than him. Romero was too busy experimenting with the brave new world that Doom was continuing to spawn. Duango and deathmatching were in full tilt. Raven's game Heretic was doing so well that Romero was already overseeing the sequel, Hexen. He had the big vision in his head, a trilogy of games from Raven based on the Doom engine, concluding with the final project, Hecatomb. He had also begun overseeing a Doom-driven game called Strife by a local group of developers called Rogue Entertainment. These games were fitting nicely into what he wanted to be id's master plan, squeezing every last drop of business and marketability out of Carmack's engines. Carmack's technology was getting more complicated and, as a result, taking longer to produce. why not use that time to pursue other projects? It didn't have to just be a company. It could be a gaming empire. Though Carmack had been skeptical, Romero felt that Heretic's success had proven his vision. As the Doom 2 phenomenon grew, the obvious way to build the company was to release more Doom product. The answer? Cash in on the Doom mods. Every home, office, or school had someone in the back who worked on computers. Now, that person was working on Doom mods. Since Doom 2, thousands of gamers had begun modifying id's products and making them available for free online. Doom fans would communicate entirely over the internet to create mods of the game, often never even meeting in person, or, for that matter, talking on the phone. It was a virtual company complete with job descriptions, responsibilities, and monikers like Team TNT and Team Innocent Crew. As a result, the mods were growing in sophistication. Among the most popular was a so-called total conversion of Doom 2 to make it look like the movie Aliens. There were deathmatch mods based on schoolyard games like Freeze Tag or King of the Mountain. People were replicating their offices, their homes, their schools. A student in England made a photorealistic version based on Trinity College. Another released one simply titled School Doom. "School is a hell," read the introductory text. "Nobody really understands why you spend your time by the computer. You are being mocked. You think about committing suicide, but then you realize it's not what you want to do. You should make the others suffer rather than yourself. You will kill them all. You will burn the school building out of the map as if it never has existed. Who cares if you are right or wrong? It's your destiny. It's your hell. It's your school doom." Such mods were taken to be all in good fun. It was just a game, after all. But some people were beginning to feel that the game had real-life applications. In Quantico, Virginia, in 1995, a project officer in the Marine Corps Modeling and Simulation Management Office, named Scott Barnett, created a modification called Marine Doom, complete with realistic military soldiers, barbed wire fences, and Marine logos. The game was perfect for training real-life soldiers in teamwork, Barnett's supervisors agreed. Barnett contacted id, who gave their blessing, though they thought the idea of someone using their game to train soldiers was a joke. But it was the real deal. The game made its way across the net and would be used by the Marines for years. Id decided to jump into the game after discovering that WizardWorks, a publisher in Minnesota, had released D-Zone, a collection of 900 user-made Doom mods, which id obviously did not own. The D-Zone CD-ROM had, remarkably, surpassed Doom 2 to top the PC game sales charts, earning millions of dollars. It was a source of great consternation in the office. This was exactly what people like Kevin Cloud had been afraid would happen. In response, Romero initiated deals with a variety of mod makers to put out id-approved collections called the Master Levels for Doom 2, as well as one sprawling team project, Final Doom. They also put out a retail version of the shareware product, Ultimate Doom. As the other projects grew, one question lingered on everyone's mind. What about Quake? Many had gotten caught up in the hype. American McGee, Dave Taylor, and Jay Wilbur had even been talking up the game themselves online. An industrious fan began collecting any sly comment made by a member of id and began putting them together in an online newsletter called Quake Talk. Romero uploaded early pictures to the net, showing how the world was shaping up. "In the screens where you see some pink-purple sky," he wrote in an explanatory note, "you can just imagine the wind whistling in your ears. You should see these screens in action." But back in the office, by the middle of 1995, there was little to see. Work was proceeding chaotically, at best. With Carmack and Abrash working on the engine and Romero spending more and more time on other projects, the others were left to their own devices. After having found happiness in a recent marriage, Adrian Carmack was growing impatient with the lack of stability at work. He and Kevin, his now close friend and fellow artist, began churning out textures for the games based on Gothic medieval schemes, as well as Aztec designs for a time-traveling portion of the game. Kevin also used the time to start learning how to create characters in 3D, something they had never done before. Adrian, frustrated by the increased game technology, left the character work to Kevin, who began to wear down from the mounting challenge. The newer ranks felt frustrations of their own. American and the other guys thought Quake was beginning to flounder. Romero, their project leader, seemed more interested in leading his own life than in leading them. When pushed at one point to create a design document for Quake, he grudgingly responded with a 2-page sketch. The rest thought it was a lazy attempt. But, as Romero was quick to explain, independence had long been id's modus operandi. They never had a design document, never wrote anything down. The only person who'd tried was his old cohort, Tom Hall, and it got him fired. The guys at id responded by resenting both Romero and Carmack. Romero was off being a rock god. Carmack was off being a tech god. And everyone else was left out to dry. Something had to change. Months were passing, and Carmack's engine was nowhere close to being done. The Wolfenstein engine had taken only a couple of months. Doom had taken 6. Already, Quake's engine was passing a half year of development with no end in sight. Forget about the promised release date of Christmas 1995, they resolved. From now on, if people wanted to know the completion date of an id game, the reply was, when it's done. Chapter 12. Judgment Day. Alex St. John was sitting at his desk at Microsoft when he got the email from Bill Gates about Doom. Word had it that there were 10 million copies of the shareware installed on computers, more than the company's new operating system, Windows 95. Microsoft had spent millions to promote the Windows 95 release in August 1995, blanketing the country with ads that asked, "Where do you want to go today?" Gates wondered how this little company in Mesquite, the same one that had seduced Michael Abrash, was outperforming him with some game. In the email, Gates asked Alex, the chief strategist for Microsoft's graphics division, if he thought he should buy id Software outright. Alex, a large red-headed man with a quick wit and easy laugh, couldn't help but chuckle. By 1995, everyone, it seemed, wanted a piece of id. Doom imitations were flooding the shelves and topping the sales charts. Dark Forces, a Star Wars-themed shooter from LucasArts. Descent, a free-flying shooter from Interplay. Marathon, a Macintosh game from a small company called Bungie. Even Tom Hall, who had always wanted to do deeper games at id, had been corralled into doing a shooter called Rise of the Triad for Scott Miller's company, Apogee. The games were now a part of the cultural lexicon. Doom was featured on television shows like ER and Friends. It was in a Demi Moore movie. It was novelized in a series of books. Hollywood was developing a Doom movie. The Marines were making a Doom training mod. Even Nintendo, the goody-goody empire that had long battled over video game violence, was porting the gory hit to its new home video game.